You're listening to Amphibicast.
This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by Grey Ghost Creations. Specializing in unique wildlife art for lovers of reptiles, amphibians, and arachnids, Grey Ghost Creations offers a wide variety of art prints, stickers, pins, necklaces, and more. To find more unique original art, be sure to visit Grey Ghost Creations on Etsy at www.greyghostcreations.etsy.com. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandra Bates, your host. And this week, I'm honored to have a return guest, another return guest you guys might remember from a series we did way back, Chris Butterworth. He is the curator of amphibians at Dallas World Aquarium and has done some very extensive work with large Columbian Ophaga species. And we have a whole big laundry list of stuff that we're going to cover. I've been looking forward to this interview for months now. I'm glad Chris and I got a chance to discuss all this amazing stuff. So we're going to, you know, put your seatbelt on. We're going to take a very, very deep dive or drive, whatever you guys want to call it, into some pretty cool Ophaga content. So stay tuned. But before we do that, of course, thank you to everybody for supporting the show. I know I mentioned this at the beginning of every episode, but I do appreciate it. The support goes a long way. The longer episodes do, it does cost a little bit more on my end, and I want to thank everybody who does support the show through the patronage. The longer episodes are getting a great reception. If you guys like that, the Patreon page does help support that. So if you are a patron, again, thank you for your patronage. And another great way to support the show, again, 5-star review on your favorite podcast player, some kind words, that goes a long way. And for everything else, check out the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to all the fun stuff for the show, merch, Patreon page, some other fun stuff as well. And of course, a big shout out to our sponsors this week. I've been able to partner up with some really great people. So again, if you haven't already done so, check out the links for the sponsors. And Chris, I'm ready to go, man. I know we had a great chat off air, and I'm ready to kind of get into some Ophaga. How are you doing tonight?
Doing well. Just enjoying everything down here and, kind of just sitting in my office, ready to have a great conversation. We had a lot of we had some people reach out after our last conversation where we talked about everything in Colombia with Jack Small and with Carlos Galvez. And I'm excited to kind of talk about my research a little bit and, have another good experience.
Yeah, and it's everyone's been looking forward to it because I remember the last time we spoke, I think that some of the research wasn't really ready to be shared, and now we've reached that point, and I'm so excited to talk about it. But Chris, for anybody who didn't catch that episode, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe tell us about your background, how you ended up working with amphibians, what your position is at your current job, and why you decided to focus on Ophaga with this work.
Oh, for sure. I'm just Texas born and bred guy. I was a college basketball player, did chemistry, did biology, ended up doing, graduate school work with, rattlesnakes, with Texas horned lizards around, north, the panhandle of Texas and the Big Bend area. And then I kind of just took a hiatus, went to Florida, worked with a couple private companies, had a little stint in the Middle East where I did some consulting work. And I came back to the United States, moved to Florida again. And as I was just kind of, taking a cue in my life, as any person in their early 20s does, I decided to make a move back home to Dallas, where the Dallas World Aquarium had a position open. I have been coming here for years. I love this place. And when I got here, the guy who was interviewing me, the director, said, "Hey, I want to have the best amphibian collection in the United States at a zoo." And I said, "Bet, we can do that." I feel like there's a lot of underrepresented clades of amphibians and zoos who are focused on more like the charismatic stuff, stuff that maybe people would recognize anywhere. So one of the genera that I said we should start working with is the Ophaga. There's just the coolest thing about the Ophaga is there's so many questions. And there's almost no answers, and there's no definitive answers, right? There's conditional answers. And so, you know, these animals and everybody very passionate about them. And I said, man, we could give these things a real shot. And then, got hooked up with Carlos down in Colombia, who is working, doing amazing work, by the way, with the Ofega Lamani. I'm actually going down there in 8 days to go for another release, into the Antioquia Valley. And, it's just, the director here has been very supportive, you know, making sure that all these species are represented and people in Dallas, you know, can come and, or anywhere, and anybody that comes here can get to experience these animals and learn a little bit about them. And, you know, when you got harpy eagles, crocodiles, and anacondas, sometimes you don't get all the looks that, from guests just working with frogs, but every now and then someone calls me up there and wants to talk about them. And that's the shit I live for. We do tons of work with the telepus. We do a lot of tree frog stuff, a lot of glass frogs, and but the Ofeg are pretty close to me. And because of all the work in Colombia, I saw an opportunity to kind of hit on something that I thought was being missed out on with amphibian conservation, with a way to improve things. And actually, you know, the Ofega aren't really at threat from climate change as much as others. They're not really at risk of the chytrid fungus as much as others. The biggest threat for them is illegal poaching and people taking them out of the environment. And that's, and also we don't know anything about them in a lot of places in Colombia. There's sampling deserts everywhere. And so I thought, well, let's do this. And maybe if we put our heads down in 10, 15 years, maybe we have another animal that's not critically endangered. We've moved them not even to endangered, but maybe even to threatened or non-threatened. And, you know, it's not like that for everything. The atelopus are getting destroyed by chytrid fungus. And so if you release them into the wild and try to improve the population, they're probably going to die because of the chytrid fungus. And so this is a unique opportunity to kind of say, look, this faucet has been turned off. Let's see if we can improve the population while we're trying to keep the fitness of the animals high, the genetics clean. And let's see how we can do this. And of course, we're at the very early stages of this road, but so far there's a lot of cooperation, internationally, interorganizationally, and, you know, it's really positive, man. And, you know, I said it earlier, the people who work with OFA are a very, passionate group. I know now, I know so much about the field stuff, the field history of OFAGA, what we know from old publications and new, and man, I learn new shit about them every day from anybody. You know, it just it's a great group. It's a great fraternity to be a part of. So fortunately, I'm not talking about the Pamilio as much. I'm talking more about the large Colombian obligates, but I do like the Pamilio too.
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on two things you mentioned, I really do think that there is a substantial rebound that's occurring with regard to wild amphibians. And I feel like it, I mean, you know, not to like rest high on our laurels and celebrate prematurely, but I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of work that's happened even within the past decade. You know, I mean, going back once this became a, you know, something that was noteworthy, I guess around like the early 90s, I feel like we are turning a corner with so many species, and the awareness and the body of research is incredible. I mean, it just leaps and bounds. Well, that was a bad pun. It's leaps and bounds away from where it was. And it's encouraging. You know, I feel like everything had been doom and gloom with amphibians as a, you know, as a whole. And it's nice to see that things are, I mean, at least in my opinion, starting to turn a substantial corner. I mean, obviously there's certain species that are going to need some more TLC, but, yeah. And, you know, another thing, when touching on the obligates, that's another thing that's interesting is how much our knowledge base of the genus has just grown exponentially with all that we know about their behavior now. And just like, I look at them completely different from any other species of frog. I've said this before. I look at them more like they're birds with their behavior and the reproductive strategies and their coloration, everything. It's just so incredible. So I can definitely see why people are attracted to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And with them, obviously there's a lot of contention about, you know, what's what, you know, is this the best way to do things for this? And something to keep in mind is just, you know, Mark Twain said, you know, it's not what you know that gets into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And sometimes because we're so passionate about it and we can kind of get a confirmation bias. I'm as guilty of it as anyone. Trying to keep that in check and say, okay, here's what it is. Here's what's known. And if we want to redo that, if we want to, you know, go in and figure out if that's true, then let's fucking do it. But that has to be the stance that we take with things. With the amphibian, you know, this the picture in general for amphibians is looking up, even if populations are declining. It's something that we have to be able to say is two things I always say to people that can kind of be controversial, but one, we have to be okay with things dying out. You know, the idea that everything lives forever is something, generally it's a thought for children. And if we can improve it, if we're the cause of it dying, that's something that can be stopped. Then of course, you know, if it's a natural process, we probably shouldn't meddle with it. It's probably something that, would maybe even be beneficial if it happened, but we have to be able to separate those two. The other thing is, humans just as a general rule are fairly egotistical, and we tend to think that everything that we do matters. And the harsh reality is, we can't really affect that much. I mean, we're not omnipresent or omnipower. We can't do all these things. So let's focus our energy and let's just say, look, you know, chytrid fungus was brought over here, introduced almost certainly by people. And that is killing off a lot of amphibians. I mean, that has killed off a lot of amphibians, but things are becoming, preliminary research would suggest that they're becoming a little more hardy to it. And some amphibians don't encounter it at all. Some of the Ophaga in Colombia are a great example of that. They really just don't experience it as much, as far as I've been able to tell. Again, we are not omnipresent, includes me. But you know, there's a lot of smart people out there who just aren't involved, and they need to be. And I hope that's always my goal, is to get the right people involved who are going to make this difference. So,
yeah, and you know, you do touch on a good point, and that's another thing that's been rattling around in my mind is, I mean, again, what I'm going to say is going to be completely subjective, but I agree with you that there's a lot of human guilt for things that we might not necessarily be directly responsible for. I mean, I cannot say with any certainty that we are directly responsible for every single species that declines and goes extinct. I mean, there's other factors that happen as well. I mean, there were species that were rare before humans even encountered them that might have just been on their way out. And I often wonder about all the species that did go extinct that we never even laid eyes on. I mean, certain things are not going to show up. Like, for example, in a rainforest environment where decay is so rapid, you're not necessarily going to find fossilized remains of a small frog that might have been there for 10,000 years. Again, paleontologists could prove me wrong, but you know, like you said, there's. I feel like we have this kind of overly idealistic view that somehow we're responsible for everything's death, and we can at the same time be responsible for resurrecting everything. And you know, as nice as that seems, you're right. It's kind of a pipe dream and not really realistic when you think about it.
There are species in this world. No matter how hard we work, we're not going to save them. I mean, and it's a testament to the adaptability of natural forms, that's the case, is that we will make everything perfect, and still not be able to accomplish it, as it once was, in the wild. And in cases like that, you know, sometimes the fight ain't worth it. And it's a very, the only real constant in nature is death. And, you know, nobody's immune to it. And that includes species, you know, but that's to say that there's a lot of people out there busting their ass, trying to do something that can make a difference. And that's what I tend to try to focus on. I would like to think that I don't need the bandwagon. You know, the Zatecki go on in Panama, you know, that is diligent work. It's a decades long process at this point. They don't need me. I'm not, in fact, I probably wouldn't help at all. You know, they've had so many great people working on that project for so long that if I come in, I mean, they kind of got it. They got an idea about what they need to do. So I try to find people who are at the grassroots phase. Zucali wasn't exactly at the grassroots phase. They had an entire national plan to save the Lamani. But I could go in there and offer a new perspective, new resources, knowledge and capabilities that maybe didn't exist. And one of the big things, one of the things that we saw after the Amphibicast last March is that there's a lot of people in the United States who are just hungry to support that shit. And that's great. That was the entire reason of me not talking about any of my research. That was for Carlos to tell people what's going on in Colombia. That's a real deal. And I'm very appreciative to Amphibicast and to you, Dan, that happened, you know?
Well, I mean, thank you. That's kind of you to say. And again, I appreciate you guys, you know, choosing this platform to share that. I mean, I have a tremendous amount of respect for frog hobbyists because I feel like, by and large, the majority of us really value this, not just on a possessive level where, okay, this is great. I own these beautiful things. I can have them in my home. I can enjoy them. But at the same time, there's this, and I don't know what it is about the large obligates, but like all my episodes where I feature large obligate content, people are just ravenous for it. And I don't know what it is. It's probably an amalgam of many things. Again, they're charismatic, they're colorful, they have amazing behavior. They're not like, you know, a poor man's frog, so to speak. They're not, you know, like a rhinoceros.
You don't pay $1,000 for a frog and not be invested in it a little bit more than just money.
Yeah. And I think that the investment of money and time and passion really translates into a success story, which is really, again, it's run the gambit, but with regards to the large obligates and even with Pamelio as well, I think that hobbyists and enthusiasts are really some of the greatest custodians of not only the frogs themselves and their, you know, breeding them and whatnot, but also the knowledge base that goes along with it. So,
yeah,
I mean, while we're talking on the knowledge base, I mean, you and I had kind of gone through a little rundown of some points that we were going to touch on for this episode. And one of the first points is the literature review, what we know, what's available. So, I mean, some of your work has focused on concentrating research articles to improve access to natural history notes, placement of some of the phenotypes within current phylogeny. I mean, some of this stuff that's on our list, like what do we know about large obligates in the literature? What can we say definitively as of now in 2024?
Ooh, definitively, man, that's a word I'm not sure I'm going to throw that word around, but the something that is almost uniform in any conversation about animals in faraway exotic places is it almost always devolves into a geopolitical context. And so if you just look up Dendrobates histrionicus, Ophaga histrionica, Dendrobates lamani, all the epithets that these guys have been since 1845 was when they were first described as Dendrobates histrionicus, and that included any Ophaga basically south of the Darien Gap in as soon as you get into Colombia. And so kind of what most people would know if you've watched Narcos or if you've kind of been interested in traveling to Colombia or to Ecuador is that the drug trade was massive there, the cocaine trade. And so there's a huge gap in the literature. Myers and Daly went down there. Stefan Loders went down there. There's a huge number of articles that come out from the late 60s to the early 80s. Loders was in the 90s, but you get this gap in between like the 80s and then like people in Colombia kind of picking it up in the 2000s. And that's when, you know, the drug trade, right? Like if you overlay, you can do this on ArcGIS. I was thinking about uploading this map, but if you do historical highways for cocaine trade, both crop manufacturing, cocaine processing, and then shipment and movement and trafficking, and you overlay that with the known ranges of the Ophaga species, it's almost like you're just laying it right over. It turns out that the Ophaga like the same exact environments that the coca plant likes. And that's unfortunate because that did lead to a bit of a gap in our knowledge. It also makes filling in those gaps kind of dubious because it's not, when you go to Colombia, it's the most beautiful place I've ever been. I just cannot even describe it to you. The people are nice. The weather's perfect. Everything's green. There's animals. You hear these animals like on your, if you have like a, you know, if you play like a jungle noises and stuff, that's basically what it's like in the middle of a city in Colombia. And unfortunately it's just really hard to get places. So if, you know, when I go to Colombia, I go to Cali and you're only 25 miles from the ocean, but it's going to take you 5 hours to get there. And that supposes that you're not going to have any issues with whoever's controlling the territory on the western side of the Andes at that time, which tends to be the current environment, is that the Colombian government doesn't really run stuff on the other side of the Andes. And that can be difficult. You can't really expect college students to go there and say, okay. It also, the terrain is just bonkers. I mean, I've lived in Texas my whole life. I'm a bit fat at this point in my life. I can't haul up no mountain. I can't, especially it's like, imagine the Rocky Mountains if it was like South Florida, you know, that's just what it is. It's humid. Every time you step, you're slipping, there's algae and moss everywhere. And it's hard to fill in those gaps. So what we know is that, you know, kind of what's been supported, there's five species. They are fairly well separated, but there's a lot of messes. We don't know if there are hybridizing zones. And if there are hybridizing zones, that might point to these guys all being one species. But as it works right now, the sample populations we have are all separated. And so what you get is you get some genetic separation, and that can lead to missuppositions in your conclusions. But as of right now, we know that the Ophaga lamani are critically endangered. The true histrionica, which people tend to call the bullseye, the black with the orange spot, is an endemic. It's in one area. It's really close to the Playa de Oro histrionica, or the Playa de Oro Ophaga andrezi. That the Andrezi are incredibly the polymorphic. There's tons of variation in that. And it turns out the Ophaga that I think I don't know if most people have trouble with this one, but the Solanensis, I've always had the Bahia Solano tend to have trouble with it, but, turns out they're probably the hardiest one. They live in the most, they have the highest, altitude differences. They had the highest preferred climate differences in their range. Their range is right now in animals that would be considered species and populations would be considered the Ophaga solanensis. It's about 200 kilometers. You know, it's a massive range, and that goes from the coast, that goes all the way inland. There's a chance that they even hybridize with Andrezi near the Atrato River. And so a lot of these things we don't know, right? And so in this literature review, I keep all of my opinions I try really hard, but I am human. I'm pretty sure I've got most of my opinions out of it. And just said, look, this is what these people found. And Andres Paso Terranova, who's the guy that did the recent phylogeny, who pulled out Ophaga solanensis, Ophaga anchicayensis, and Ophaga andrezi from Ophaga histrionica proper, he's on my PhD committee. And so I have lots of really candid talks with him. I mean, incredible guy, by the way. He lives in Canada. He's part of the National Guard in Canada. And he's a professor up in Saskatchewan, just a really cool guy. He understands that people will have contention with his conclusions. And he'll be the first to say, if there are hybridizing zones, chances are those populations are very different than the ones in the areas where you're able to sample. As of right now, that's kind of what we know. We know that illegal poaching has ravaged some of these populations, and that tesoros had, in my opinion, has been almost unilaterally responsible for stymieing that instance. The illegal, if you offer a legal alternative, even if it's marked up an insane amount. I mean, there's records of some Europeans going into Colombia and giving people $5 for each blue Ophaga that they got. I mean, and can you imagine that kind of market, just for Ophaga, when, blues go for, depending on the sex, $700 to $1,300, $1,400. And I think Ivan and Tesoros have been like just critical in helping stop that. Some of the other things is that there's a lot of outliers that we don't quite understand where they're from, because they haven't been sampled, which is something that Andres and I are working on, namely the blues. I have a good idea about where they're coming from. And that if they were to be thrown into a species, they're going to be thrown in with the Pleiodoros. I know that might make some people crazy. It makes me crazy, which is why I'm trying to answer it. But the blues, blue histrionica, the atratos, there's just a ton of outlying phenotypes that we need to, probably look into. I almost don't want to say this, but I think the situation in Colombia is opening up to where getting out there and investigating these things is becoming more possible. Also, there's a ton of people domestically in Colombia who want to do this shit. People who are passionate about these animals. I think there's going to be an opportunity for hobbyists, like honest to God hobbyists, to have a really big impact on the science behind this genus in the future.
Do you think it's beneficial to have a grassroots effort? Maybe grassroots is kind of a poor choice of words. I should say like a domestic effort, meaning
yes,
like, I don't like to proselytize and to tell people in other parts of the world what they should do. And I don't like to make my problems somebody else's problems. And at the same time, I feel like there's a tremendous amount of value in appreciating your own conservation efforts at a local level. Like here in New York, bald eagle restoration was a big thing since I was a kid in the 80s. And now, where I live on the island, there's quite a few bald eagle nests, and they're actually displacing the ospreys, which was kind of an unintended thing. And that's kind of ticking people off too. But it's a domestic thing. You're the one with the boots on the ground. You're the one who's looking at these animals. You're the one who's seeing them every day. Has that local enthusiasm helped? Because I mean, that seems to be the message that I'm getting. And even if it's in Panama, if it's in wherever, is that what you're seeing in Colombia?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just beneficial. It's vital. If you do not have it, what you're working on will almost certainly not succeed unless you've got Elon Musk funding you. Because the analogy I always use, I'm a country guy, so I'm big on analogies. But the analogy I've always used is They're driving the car. I'm just pushing. That's all I'm here to do is support. And because you're right. Wherever it is, nobody's going to have a bigger stake in the survival of that species than the people who live among that species, or who are from the same country as that species. You know, there's a pride about it. You'll have to ask Jack about this story, but when we're leaving Cali, right, you're looking everywhere for just something with the Ofega on it. You know, there's, you know, shirts at these stores. There's no frogs. It's a lot of birds, a lot of mammals. And then, you know, you go to the airport at Cali, there's a gift shop, and they had these unbelievable, treated wooden, coasters with the Ofega antichinensis on them. Gorgeous. And I was like, we just freaked out. We were like debating. It's like, all right, you take this one. How many people you got? Okay, I'm going to get them. I mean, it was just a, there's a pride about it, and you can really see it kind of with all this. You know, Zoo Cali basically has they're kind of front of the line. If there's a confiscation or if there happens to be a group of Ofega that come up and they can't be returned to the wild, they basically go to Zoo Cali. I know there was a confiscation a few weeks ago in Bogota by a woman who was, I think she was Brazilian. I forgot where she was going. I got some insider information that those were actually Sylvatica from Nariño. So those were the koi Sylvatica. And I know that's an ongoing case. They're trying to figure out where all that is. But, sometimes a story like that can make people kind of clinch their pearls a little bit. And in this case, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. Being able to have access, sole access to an endemic group an endemic genus is a good thing. It means that there won't be as much wrongdoing, but it also has to be enriched a little bit, because if someone comes in there and says, "Hey, I got $100 for every frog you bring me," and they can. You know, there will always be ways to smuggle things out. Even, you know, the United States, it's hard to smuggle things in. There's always a way to do it. And you have to disincentivize the people there who know where these animals are and who can lead people to them. If you can do that, we're on a great road already. That's where I want to get to. I want to get to the place where nobody's taking these things out of the wild, whether nobody can get to them or nobody in the area is going to take them to them. But the grassroots efforts, the in situ ex situ stuff is vital. You have to have it. And also that's kind of what science is about. It's about, you know, coming together for a common goal. And it makes, you know, I've met some great people down there. People I talk to all the time who are hilarious people. You know, they're funny, but they're passionate. And that's one of the things I tell people about Carlos is like, Carlos is extremely passionate about this shit. So don't play with him. Like he is very passionate about it. So, and I am too, but I'm more like lighthearted than him.
Yeah. I remember seeing the pictures of the koi that got confiscated, and I don't know the whole story, so I'm not really going to comment on it, but from having conversations with different people over the past few years, the pattern, and again, I don't know if it's just coincidence or just the way that it turned up, but the pattern seems to be that whenever the hobby or whatever you want to call it gets wind of legal exportation of something new, somehow poaching happens first. You know what I mean? It's almost like...
Are you referring to the fact that Tesoros is probably going to offer the koi? The Nariño Sylvatica.
Anybody who's going to offer anything new, whether it's an import, whether an export from Tesoros or whether it's something from Panama, wherever. But yeah, man, I'm referring to the koi, because I know that they're expected to be exported, I think, within the next year or so.
Yeah.
But from having conversations with different people, it seems like whenever there's going to be a legal export, there's always that problem that the poachers are going to say, all right, well, now people are ready for this. Let's poach some and get them out of the country illegally, and that seems to kind of screw up the whole process, because now you have legal frogs getting confused with illegal. You know what I mean? It just it muddies the waters to the point where you go through all this work to prepare a legal export, go, you know, get the, I mean, it's, again, from talking with Yvonne, I know it's a huge process, and I think they only do it like twice a year, but you know, to go through that, it's leaps and bounds and leaps and bounds, and then when you have poaching come and undermine that, it's like kind of like everyone's just rolling their eyes like, oh boy, like,
yeah,
you know, now what?
Yeah, and I think another thing it does is subconsciously it might tell people, it's like, well, how's the Soros getting their frogs, you know? And I think the first person to denounce that shit will be me, but also Yvonne. Like, he's like, look, he didn't bust his ass building that company, to building that whole organization and doing all the work he's done to just do something like that. Like, that's just, I kind of count it as ridiculous. And they're bad actors everywhere. It's no secret that Ofega, you know, costs a lot of money. If you can get them out of Colombia. And so people from everywhere are going to try to go do it. It turns out, I think Nariño is one of the easier places to go find those, you know, to get access to the Silvatica, to some of the Ofega there. I know a young lady who works down there, and she says, yeah, it's just not, you know, they're doing really well down there. So, you know, it's unfortunately, sometimes I mention to the people on there, if I trust them, how much that frog might be worth in the United States. And they just like, don't tell anyone that here. Just don't mention it. And I never do. I never do.
Yeah. That's like, and I mean, just so everyone, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Yvonne. I have a tremendous amount of respect for what goes on at the Soros. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Carlos as well. Everybody down there that I've had on the show that I've had the pleasure to talk with, I just, you know, want to reiterate the fact that they're doing this, all of this, this whole picture, whether it's, you know, Histrionica, Lamani, whatever. It's so hard to do this the right way. I mean, I'm sure it's hard to do it the wrong way, but it's even harder to do it the right way. So, you know, everybody who's gone through all of these leaps and bounds to try and make this a reality, I have a tremendous amount of respect for, because I couldn't imagine doing any of this full time. I mean, some of these people are so committed to this that I just, it boggles the mind how, you know, how much dedication it takes to go into this. But, yeah, I mean, like, with regards to protecting the locations, me, like, the analogy I use is, like, if I was out in the woods one day and I saw a unicorn, I'm not saying shit about it. No one will know that it was there but me, because as soon as you say it, then everybody's looking for it. So yeah, you're right. You have to be kind of cautious and diplomatic about who knows what and what knows where. But, you know, again, people are always going to find it no matter what. You know, all it takes there's a demand for everything out there, anything. Yep. And some way, somehow, someone's going to figure it out.
I mean, when you go to where the Ofega are, I mean, as a hobbyist first, before I was a scientist, I was a hobbyist, and the first, Jack and I were just looking at these plants. We're like, holy shit, dude, look at all of these plants. You know, it's insane. It's a beautiful place. It's paradise, and that's where they're meant to be. You know, it's nice to have a chunk of it here, as long as it's sustainable, as long as it's done. And yeah, Yvonne is key to that, and keeping it that way is, you know, a huge part of it is having a national pride about it, having a grassroots, having an endemic care for the things that are Colombian. And they do. The people of Colombia are beautiful people. They care about Colombia. They love being Colombian. You know, that's what I'll say. They love being Colombian.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to be proud of who you are. And I think it's nice that, like, I've seen this happen as well. I've seen it happen with Satechi in Panama, EVAC. Gardo has like a little, they have like parades, and you know, and it's like, it's the Satechi is an iconic animal, the same way as like the bald eagle is up here. And I feel like just having that appreciation for what's right in front of you goes further than somebody else on the other side of the world, you know, trying to run the show.
Yes, and obviously, as an American, I know that Americans almost always mean well, but sometimes the optics are all that matter, and we all have to be conscious about that. And so when I started going down there, I told them, I was like, look, man, I'm not even the kind to do it here in Texas. I'm not a barking orders kind of guy. And I'm not the kind of guy that wants to take the reins from people. And so if you need help with something, tell me and I'll work on it. But I'm not going to be out here asking people for stuff, because I'm very conscious about the perception that an American's coming in here trying to tell us all what to do to save some shit that's ours anyway. You know, You got to avoid that, because nobody likes that, including Americans. Americans don't like it when Americans do it to them. So I'm definitely not going to do it to somewhere else, especially when they know more than I do. You know, so
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think that it's like, that's another thing is important, is to, you know, be respectful and understand that, you know, many, and this is with everything in life. I mean, maybe it's just me lecturing, but, you know, always remember when you're a guest in someone else's home. And I think that's one of those things that I think a lot of people don't really keep in mind. But yeah, always remember when you're somebody's guest, and you know, the best way to get your voice across is to keep your mouth shut.
Yes, I mean, keeping your mouth shut is number one way to save your ass in another country or any tense situation. Just shut up.
Very true.
You're not going to say anything. You're not going to say anything and make everything better. So,
yeah. And, you know, I want to back up a little bit, though, about the taxonomy. And taxonomy fascinates me for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, it's our way of making sense out of other organisms, because as human beings, we like to classify things, we like to quantify them, we like to put them into boxes. But I mean, the more that taxonomy evolves, and because nothing in taxonomy seems to be finite, you have to ask yourself, and this might seem like a controversial question, but when you think about something that's identified as a species, we'll say, let's just say Pimelio, for example. We in the hobby value Pimelio for its variability. It's unique. It comes from, there's different locales, there's different color variations. It's almost innumerable. We'll forget everything else. We'll forget the behavior and whatnot. But technically, Pimelio is not a species is not in any significant danger of going extinct, to my knowledge. Whereas different locales will face unique pressures. If these things were not colored differently, would we value these individual locations as much as we do? And again, it's more of like a, like I said, there's, it's not a right or wrong answer. It's just something that I'm thinking about, because I'll draw a parallel. With mammals, we've got the wolf, right? And there's, I think, something like 12 or 15 different subspecies of wolf. And there's the taxonomy of the eastern wolf population is kind of out there, because supposedly now it's considered to be a hybrid between, I think, eastern coyotes and North American wolf species. So it's like in this kind of limbo, it's still a wolf, but is it not? And the same thing with a lot of the locales. I mean, obviously, I mean, my opinion is, I think that they all have value. They all should be protected in some or managed in some way, shape, or form. But I mean, from a taxonomy purpose, what do you think? I mean, do they warrant being considered subspecies? Like, would that help preserve them, or do they still just belong under one banner and they just happen to look different here and there?
Yeah, I think because there already exists other Central American Ophaga species, the Vincenti and the Arborea, but the other Central American Ophaga species, because those exist, we kind of know what these populations of Pimelio are not, right? So we can run those against that and say, okay, these are Pimelio. They all group together. If they're subspecies, If they're at risk, I think sometimes people won't look at that and see that for what it is. That is a near sympatric speciation or a symmetric separation of different colors with very little overlap. That is an incredible thing. And people do study this. They study the hell out of this. Some really brilliant people study, how do you get all these colors? And what does that mean? Is that there surely there aren't, you know, predators that are specializing on that color or that stay away from that color, like an aposematic warning. But is that sexual selection? Is that something? So I think just for the purposes, just as a science is looking at it, I want those things to exist because I want to know how the hell they got there. You know, that's the Ofe, especially of Bocas del Toro and the entire northern part of Panama. And even into Costa Rica, you know, just to go from the fairly conserved red or black, red with blue or black legs, maybe some spotting, but to go from that to the wild coloration we see is so cool. And thankfully there's a lot smarter people than me working on it. And I think it is worth protecting, but the good thing is that, I mean, Panama is very invested in protecting those and their wild areas. They capitalize on ecotourism long before before anyone. And so if you know, with frogs, it's a little bit different than doing it with wolves. With wolves, there's stakeholder considerations to take into account. You know, like farmers and people with dogs and all that stuff. You know, but with the Pamilio, if the whole thing is the genetic diversity or just the phenotypic diversity, because it turns out I don't think many of those phenotypes are separated very much in their genotype, even if they're all one species, you know, that's worth protecting.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's just kind of one of those things that I one of the goals of the show is not so much, it's also to get people to think. You know what I mean? And this is one of those things that kind of mull over in my head is, and it's going to sound like heresy, but it's almost like, are we encouraging, how do I put this tactfully? Are we overly concerned about the well-being of a very small population of a larger ranging species? And I mean, again, I don't believe that. I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate.
That could totally be in taxonomy, in phylogenetics and systematics. There are lumpers and there are splitters. I traditionally am a lumper. I see things where people call them species, and I'm like, no, that's probably a population. All genetics, most genetics, functions at a population level, right? A mountain lion from West Texas and a mountain lion from Alaska probably have a very conserved genetic profile, but it's the differences that make the point. And it's the differences that you see in the population. If there is like, you know, a lot of the phenotypic stuff has been shown to be linked to toxicity, at least in the Pamilio, at least in some forms. And if that's the case, then, you know, maybe that's an environmental factor that's affecting coloration, but it's probably a little bit of both. You know, there's so many variables when you're talking about the evolution of specific forms, and you know, I think that that's going to be, you know, pretty fun. It's always pretty fun stuff to get into with the Pamilio, because you can go down there and see them, and it's really not that difficult. I think flights are only like $300. Go from Dallas to Panama City, get on a bus, go to Bocas del Toro, and rent a room, rent an Airbnb, and go around and see amazing frogs. And that's great. I love that. I hope to do that someday. I've never been to that. I've never been to the Bocas del Toro, but I hope to go someday.
That's on my bucket list. Yeah, I remember having a conversation with, for the life of me, I wish I could remember who it was. And we were talking about, it was a researcher I had on the show. I can't remember who it was. We were talking about clutch size versus large variation in phenotype. And it's basically the crux of the discussion was that in tropical environments with high biodiversity, there's a correlation between speciation and color variation. So what was speculated was that the frogs, by virtue of the fact that they produce smaller clutches as opposed to explosive breeders like tree frogs, and have this very, very broad palette of different color morphs, maybe all those things together might be a catalyst for more speciation, meaning, 10,000 years from now, these things might be even more different from a taxonomist perspective than they are now. Again, it's just food for thought. It's just stuff I'm mulling over in my head. But it's a unique dynamic that when you think about it, if we do take an interest in a specific locale today, depending on the course of human history, which might not go well, but let's just say for argument's sake, we're still on the planet 10,000 years from now, it might be a different species. I don't know. Again, as I'm thinking of different angles about how we care for the environment, how we care for these frogs, again, all right, I'll come out of the rabbit hole now.
I think I've gone too far. That's a good point because, the number one question you have to answer is like, well, what's a species? I don't know how many species concepts there are, but I mean, there's over 20 and there's new ones every day. And as far as the small clutch size, the Ophaga, what my research focuses on is the cost of reproduction for an animal and amphibians that are generally R selectors, meaning they have lots of really small babies. And it's just numbers game. It's like sea turtles, right? And the Ophaga are, anybody that breeds them will tell you they're not like that. They are they're obligated to feed their young, which is something that is absolutely crazy in amphibians. It does happen. And a lot of times it happens incidentally. But with the Ophaga, if you have a female that, has a clutch of 6 eggs, she transports 4, feeds 3, and she's feeding 3, 50 to 60 eggs, that is a huge cost of reproduction. But what it guarantees, and what it almost always guarantees, is that those larvae are going to leave the water and they're going to be started pretty well. And I'm interested in how much that actually costs to the female, and how many times can she do it, and can she do more? What if she's pushed to her limits? And that can lead to crazy variation when you start talking about the effects of allostatic load, or how much stress an animal can take on before it starts really changing, what's going on in the body. At a hormone level or at an anatomical level. These are all questions that need to be answered. And again, all that's for the Ophaga Lamani project. I want to know, a lot of people know they see maybe, I think Jack posted a picture of the red Lamani that we saw when we went to Anchikaya last time. I mean, just a breathtaking frog. Never seen one like that in the hobby. And so there is some sort of, captive washout where the colors do drop, and they go to like an orange, and then eventually they get to like the light orange that tend to be what we have in the hobby here. And how does that affected? A lot of people think it's carotenoids, but I think everybody's been trying carotenoids for a while. I've never seen a Lamani that red, and I haven't seen one close to that red. I see a lot of large form redheads that are strikingly red, but whether their babies are red is again the question. No matter how many carotenoids you put in it, it's probably not going to help. It's a different question that happens a lot lower on a subcellular level, and I'm still new to that game, but it's something that is an active part of my research.
Yeah, let's talk about this quantification of reproduction. So, can you get into a little bit more detail about what that means with regards to the projects that you're working on now? Like, an obligate to reproduce. Okay, we'll back it up. We'll say just, you know, a pair has to court. They have to mate. Eggs need to be laid. Infertile eggs need to be deposited as a food source. Some degree of parental care. Tadpole behavior. Tadpoles rear out. What kind of an energy cost does that warrant to have a positive outcome? Because it's a tremendous, and again, this is why I compare them to birds. It's like, it's just so much parental care goes into this. Like, what do we know about the rate of success for breeding pairs with all of this energy put into it? Like, how do they compare with populations of frogs that, you know, produce more young and just kind of have like more of like a shotgun approach to reproduction?
So in the wild versus in captivity are two very different things. The ophaga are, it's funny, my advisor for my PhD is a mammalogist who studies lactation, but also the trade-offs between maternal care and offspring fitness. And that's where a lot of this comes in. I said on the last time I was on here is that you have to be really careful in captivity because you get a very different animal very quickly with even captive breeding programs where you're trying to account for everything, UV, for substrate, for the species of plants you're putting in there. There's almost always as many variables as you're hitting, you're probably missing that many, and maybe those are the key ones. And so what I want to know specifically is, you know, we have a captive reproduction effort at Zoo Cali for the Lamani. They're breeding an insane number of Lamani at this point. They've released, I think, 117 into the wild, and they're releasing about half that they produce so that they can kind of select for the ones that appear bigger, that have the darker color. And maybe that's the way to go. Maybe it's not, but we don't know that for sure. A good way to know, there's just so many ways to tackle this. So if I want to know, how do we produce the greatest number of offspring while at the same time balancing the trade-offs of female health and making sure that we're not producing low quality offspring, right? Because there's I have to plug this book. Captive Management, Conservation of Amphibians and Reptiles from 1994. And there's an article in here by Zimmerman and Zimmerman, who are two of the OGs from Germany, who were raising ophaga, hybridizing Lamani and Angiochiensis, and getting the kind of hybrids we see in the wild. And they were raising them off of chicken egg yolk. And they go into detail about this, and they detail the courting of not just the ophaga, but also the phylobates, which are also critically endangered, or also endangered, I think. I think they're just endangered. That's an incredible book. And on the cover, they have, you know, a pretty cool layout of some of the ophaga. But if you want to raise ophaga, I have at the aquarium, I have an army of familial that I use to do my metabolic studies, because I don't want to do invasive studies with the large obligates. And so I do them with the familial. They are a model species for my focal species. And if I really wanted to, I could start pulling my Lamani tadpoles and pulling familial tadpoles and euthanize the familial, put the Lamani in there, and the familial will raise them. I've had it happen. But they come out very small. They come out, you know, whether they make it. There's generally, with ophaga, what I found is if you can get the froglet to 90 days out of the water, it's almost always going to survive. How healthy it's going to be, what its fitness will be, not just, and again, fitness in captivity is not what I'm after. I want to know, how fit is it going to be when we take it up into the Antioquia Valley and we let it go? I want to know, is it fit enough to survive there? And we don't know that. We don't know that very well right now. We know that they can survive up there, but the question isn't, let's make as many as possible. Let's take a picture for Instagram. Let's post it. Let's get lots of likes. And let's just, you know, pat ourselves on the back and go home. I want to save them. I want to try to do as much as I can to bolster that population. And if we can do that, then this can be extrapolated to the other Ophega who might need it. Whichever ones might, you know, very few of, you know, the Solanensis look like they're doing pretty good. The Anchiensis are a mess because there's like 7 different forms that are included in it. And it probably just the Histrionica that we are worried about. The Andrezi, again, seem very diverse, very widespread. So they're probably doing fine, you know. But if we can do it with Lamani, then we can do it with the Histrionica. You know, that's something to me that's at least worth knowing. And what preliminarily what my research shows is that it's pretty costly, and it can be offset, but there are no solutions to anything. There are only trade-offs. So you can choose to do certain things, but you always have to account for those trade-offs, and that's tough to do in living systems, especially when I have these in Dallas. I'm trying to extrapolate that to Zucali, and I'm trying to extrapolate both of those to, you know, the wild. It's a complex picture. But there's a lot of progress being made, you know. A lot of what I'm seeing, it has to do with enclosure size. It has to do with if you have a person, they wake up every morning, they run 5 miles, that person's probably more fit in more situations than I am currently, for sure. But if you can give an animal a pair of Lamani, you know, a lot of people would keep those. Some people give them an 18-18-24. You can breed them there and they're happy. They'll do that. But when you're trying to answer questions about wild Lamani, I have some at the aquarium here that are in 2-foot by 2-foot by 6.5-foot enclosures. And I'm testing their metabolics versus some that I keep in a, what is it? It's a medium tall. No, it's a large tall, 36 wide, 18 deep, 24 high, you know? And I want to know what is the female produced? How many, first of all, I'm trying to quantify how many young they're raising a year. How many eggs are they feeding each tadpole? How many tadpoles are they raising at a time? Will they overlap? Will they raise one clutch? And as they'll start getting done, they'll start raising another one. And when those come out, what's their weight when they emerge? And what you see is the animals in the bigger enclosure, because I put the cups to raise them. I put them up at the top of the tank. They're at 6.5 feet tall, but they always get fed on the ground. So there's a lot of up and down going. And if you, when you go to Columbia, that's what you see is a lot of the bromeliads are pretty high. They're I'm 6'7" and they're over my head. You can't really even look at them. So what you see is that the ones in the 18, 24, 36 will probably raise more, offspring, but they'll be about, you'll have about the same clutch mass. So when the larvae, when the froglets come out of the water, the number of froglets that come out of the water in the shorter tank will be higher. You'll have 3 or 4 versus 2, maybe 3. I think I've had 3 once, but it's usually 2. But the ones that come out are massive of the tall tank. And the female's body condition, another thing that I track is a true body condition, which I use a scaling mass index for that, which is an algorithm you can plug into. I could even make it available. I kind of wanted to make it like a public thing so people could just plug their animals into it. But you plot snout bend length versus mass, but you do it in a logarithmic form, and you look for a consistent slope for what's normal, and then you check animals based on that. So if you have a big fat male, you know, he's going to plot higher on that. But if you have a female, that body condition is going to go wild. I mean, it's going to vary a lot. And so I tend to get more froglets from the shorter tanks, but I tend to get what I would consider better froglets, from the larger tanks. That's preliminary stuff. And that has to be run a lot in a lot of different ways with a lot of different variables so that I can make sure that what I'm saying right now isn't just, you know, what I'm doing right now. You know, it has to hold.
Yeah, these are the variables that intrigue me, because, I mean, like you said earlier, a wild frog is not the same animal as a captive frog. And from talking to Carlos last time, Carlos and I spoke, that was one of the things that he was also working on, was trying to figure out how to create a wild Lamani in a captive situation, not just another captive Lamani. And I think one of the things he was talking about, I don't remember if it was Lamani or a different species, but even the climate in that particular location where they were being captive bred was slightly different from where this was one species existed, whether it was lower ambient humidity, or I think one part was more of a cloud forest and the other one was a lowland. Again, I don't remember all of the specifics, but in general, because obviously, I guess we're not there yet, but in general, are these variables becoming more significant in terms of creating an animal that's captive bred, but viable in the wild?
I think the viability is constant. Our understanding of it is changing. And so at Zoo Cali in the amphibian lab, if you can picture a golden corral, the golden corral, the majority of it is the Lamani. It's very humid in there. They use foggers, not mist. They keep the temperature a bit lower. And then in the party section off in the corner, that's where the other Ophaga are. That's where the Terribilis are, anything else they have. And that's a bit warmer. And so, the variables are very different. It's one of the fun questions about, well, if that's the case, if these guys are that different, then how do the Lamani and the Inchparensis hybridize? In multiple occasions, from what we know, at least three different times, it's producing three different phenotypes. And so, but if that happens, then someone's variable. Someone can go places where we think they can't. And that's probably the Inchparensis, because they're pretty widespread as well. And if we want to say, okay, the Lamani are going to be up here on this mountaintop, they're probably not. They can venture down into the lower section, the lower reaches, to like some of the roads and stuff. But for the most part, they're going to be here. That's where we want them. And so at Zoo Cali, there's an area where we're looking at maybe constructing some big outdoor enclosures to expose them to things. One of the best ways to get to get animals that are going to be more viable is to expose them to shit that, as someone who pays $1,000 a frog, we're just not going to do that. Like, you know, we're not going to. If you see the water that some of these Lamani are raised in, I mean, it is just a cesspool filled with larvae, filled with decaying plant matter, with bird shit, just all kinds of stuff in there. And when I know that, I've seen it for myself. And when I keep large obligates, I'm keeping them in not pristine water, but I'm washing it out. Like, I'm cleaning it out quite often. Getting all the old stuff out of there, making room for the newer eggs and stuff. That, as crazy as it sounds, that may be something we have to do, is say, look, these guys need to experience some bad stuff to be able to make it through life in the Inchcaya. And it's as a human who's trying to take care of something that we perceive as delicate, and they are delicate, but they're probably not delicate in the way we think about it, you know. And that's, you're always having to challenge, you know, the way you see things. You're always having to challenge that. And so who knows? I'm gonna answer some of these other things first, and then I'm gonna get to putting bird shit in with my Lamani. I'm not too wild about that as a future, but you know.
Well, then it begs the question, which kind of a bird? Yeah, again, may sound silly, but it's, could that have an influence on it as well? I mean, just hear me out. This may sound ludicrous, but do wild Lamani select sites that get, you know, certain species of bird to crap in the bromeliads? I who knows?
Well, maybe the bromeliads select for that. What we do know is that the males control territories. Just of habitat, you have males that control territories. The males who have the most bromeliads will almost always be the strongest males, and they'll have the most females passing through, and they'll have the most offspring. So the sites, the deposition sites or the rearing pool sites, is a key variable, and whether or not those are selected for on any scale, whether it's the bromeliads being ending up there or whether it's, you know, the female selecting for that. I would say that's maybe a bit out of the question, but what do I know? I just study them. Yeah.
Here's another question for you. With the Lamani that we have in captivity that are in the trade, I mean, in your opinion, how do they differ from the wild Lamani?
They're smaller. They are smaller. They obviously, you have the color differentials, but even when you see like an orange Lamani, you get kind of the banding is a little bit different. It's more orange on the face, and you know, the bands can be a lot more narrow. And other than that, I'm not thinking they're that different. It's probably just their ability to exert themselves in the wild is probably a lot higher than the ones that we have here in the hobby. But that could be answered maybe in two generations with enclosure size. You know, you increase the metabolic capacity of an animal, and it will pass some of that down to its offspring. And if you do that for two generations, the second generation offspring are going to be pretty legit, and they might be able to, and by the way, if they're able to do that, then they might be able to raise bigger offspring and get them started. Another thing is food. You know, what people can feed the Lamani in the captivity, a wide range of things. Out in the wild, we saw the ant species they eat. That's a difficult thing to try to duplicate. Anytime you're talking about raising ants, you know, to feed something. But again, it's another variable that might need to be accounted for, and not just with the formic acid or the formicin vitamin supplement, like legit ants. And so one of the things that I do is, in fact, it's so warm here in Texas now, you can go do it, is we're going out and collecting termites, and you feed termites, and you know, I don't know what the change is. I know they love them, and I know they tend to breed a little bit more as far as when I'm quantifying, you know, how many eggs they're dropping to their offspring. They're gonna lay more if they get termites, because termites is basically just big gummy bears full of fat, you know. So,
what are your thoughts on fruit flies as a staple that we use for so many species? Because it's convenient, we can dust them, but realistically, I mean, after what you just mentioned about termites, can we do better with a food source that's going to produce healthier animals? I mean, not, let's forget the trade, but let's talk more about trying to, like, reintroduction efforts. Like, are there any other alternatives besides? Because, I mean, the U.S., it's complicated, because then with any kind of insect, then you get, like, USDA involved, and it can be, like, it's weird. Like, it's harder to bring in a plant or an insect than it is to bring in a crocodile. So, yeah. Like, that's also a barrier, but what kind of resources do you guys have at the aquarium with regards to, like, getting access to different types of feeders and maybe giving a diet that the average hobbyist wouldn't really be able to do so simply?
Well, at the aquarium, because we aren't going to be as invested in the kind of variables that we're talking about. Well, we want to have healthy animals with great enclosures where people can see them, or we can raise awareness about them. But we want healthy, and you know, variation is a good way. You know, the fruit flies are pretty good, especially compared to some of the other feeder items. They're pretty good. They're deficient in a couple things, but everything's deficient in something. And you can gut load fruit flies depending on the media, and I would consider myself a novice when it comes to me. I know there's guys here at the aquarium that know more about that than I do. But what I know is if you can supplement the fruit flies and you vary your supplementation, and every now and then you give them something else, I always keep springtails. One, because it allows me to put calcium clay in the enclosure, which when you go to the Inchkaya, there's clay there. I mean, and that's something that, that you'll always see if you move through about, you know, 8 inches of leaf litter, it's clay. You know, it's, and the termites, again, is something that I've done for a while. I like going out and collecting termites to feed their frogs. Frogs seem to love it. Fruit fly larvae, also packed with fat, something that hasn't been turned into chitin yet. So there's a lot more available for the frog there. If you got a frog that you're medicating, you know, I always use fruit fly larvae. Just scoop them out with a spoon and put them on a banana and let them go to town. But at Zoo Cali, one of the things that we're going to talk about this time is seeing how feasible would it be to take to get a colony of those ants. It, maybe they even occur in the city, and using that as a feeder resource. Feeding ants is very difficult. One, because things that eat ants tend to be specialists. The research points to Lamani as being a case of that. Being ant, well, not just the Lamani, but all the Ophega. The chances are is that it's just that's just how common ants are down there. You just look down and there's like six ant species walking around. But if that's the case, that 86 to 92% of their diet is ants, we need to figure out a way to feed them ants. If we're talking about releasing these things in the wild, or else they're going to be out there looking for fruit flies, and we're not going to know. They're not going to know what the fuck to do. You know.
No, that's a good point. When you think about, I didn't even think about that, about feeding behavior. I mean, how much of that is learned?
And I know this from working with Texas horned lizards, who are ant specialists. They eat harvester ants. You can culture harvester ants. So what I used to do is just go out with a vacuum to a harvester ant colony, put the, and just vacuum up a bunch of ants, and I'd take them back to the lab and feed horned lizards, which are just, you know, kind of useless little lizards, but they're covered in armor. They have evolved to eat just these things, basically. But if you put too many ants in there, that horned lizard is going to die. And so you have to introduce them in what I call, you have to create feeding instances. And this works with dart frogs that are cautious, that tend to be pretty timid. If you open the door, if you have an Exoterra or a Euro tank or however you keep your frog, but if you put a dusted fruit fly out there, And the frog is able to sense it and comes closer. If you can do that, if you can take the time to do that, one, that frog will become more associated with your presence and be less scared of you. You know, some frogs are a lost cause. I have an Andrezi. I have an Andrezi female that is scared to death no matter what I do. But I have to know, for my research, I have to know how many fruit flies is this frog going to eat before it turns away. Once it turns away, you kind of expect that it's hit its anatomical limit for holding fruit flies, its digestive possibilities, right? And so if you do that with dart frogs, that's good. But if you have ants, you have got to do that, or else you just dump ants in there. You know, it would be a fun poll to question people who have large obligates, even if they don't have a big collection. If they just have a pair or one, they say, how many ants would you dump in with your large obligate? They'd be like, none. I'd never do that in a million years. That's dumb. You know, and that's right. That's exactly right. So, but you know, if they eat ants, we got to be able to feed them ants, and we have to figure out how we can do that.
You know, that kind of clarifies something that had been on my mind since the summertime. I had kind of this ant invasion over the summer, and it was scary as hell, but it was kind of amazing to watch. They came in from outside through this little opening the size of a pen point, and they made their little chemical trail, and they went right into my one of my Tinctorius. It was an aquarium. Thankfully, it wasn't one of the bigger planet tanks. It was an aquarium. I was able to move it. I mean, Chris, these things set up shop in there, and the frog was not having it at all. It did not eat. I was like, all right, a couple of ants. Does the frogs, you know, wipe them out? Nope. It had no interest in them. I don't know what the factor was, but I mean, like the way you pointed out, it could have been, you know, substantially behavior related too, because it didn't know what they were.
it's probably a density issue. If an animal senses that there's too much of a prey, if you take fruit flies and pour them all over any frog besides maybe like a Turbulus or an Amiriga, they're going to take off. They don't want to be covered in ants, you know. They don't want to be covered in fruit flies. They don't want to be covered in anything. They want to eat. They want to forage and they want to go about their life. But yeah, the novelty and the density were probably the issues there. But if you were to eradicate those ants and maybe take one ant and put them in there, there's a chance that they might have gone for it. Although the ants that you probably had versus the ants that they would experience, I don't know about the Tinctorius. I'm not good on my Suriname and Brazil entomology, but the likelihood that they would maybe have a go at something small. I've seen Tinctorius eat springtails, so the fact that they wouldn't have a go at something that's small and can fit in their mouth, I think they'd go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a nightmare though. There were like, they set up shop inside the tank. I actually had to take the whole thing apart and break it down, and I think they were after the plants. It was kind of like a garbage tank. It really wasn't that well put together. It was housing. I had received an animal that was supposed to be sexed as male, and it turned out to be female. So I ended up moving it into this, not visually stunning tank, but it had everything it needed. But I just had pothos in there. So I think that's what they were after, was the moisture, or I don't know if they were pulling something out of the pothos leaves or what, but just trying to get them out of there was just like, it was a nightmare. Yeah. It took like a week of just moving the tank. I actually ended up moving the tank into the middle of my floor, and that stopped them from coming in from outside. But then I had to get them out of the tank because they were like, there was like hundreds of them in there. They wouldn't leave. Well, that's a story for another time.
Yeah. Ants.
Yeah. It's a mixed blessing. I want to move on to our next topic though. And, I'd like to discuss some of the other aspects of your project. Let me put my list here. So I've got, we covered the rate of deposition and metabolism. Your project, okay, so understanding the links between the specific mode of reproduction and the success of focused breeding programs. So extending female reproductivity, how does that happen? Like when you look at a female and you say, okay, I want to utilize this female as a, you know, as a breeding female with the ability to produce as many offspring as possible. How does that factor into all that?
Yeah. So all animals have shelf lives, various occurrences in life history can accelerate the shelf life, or they can reduce the shelf life, or in some cases maybe you can conserve a little bit of it. And I think what I'm very interested in is, you have an adult female at a breeding program. That is the key. You know, if you got two males but you got 20 females, you're probably good to go, because you can do back crosses. You can even clean up the genetics that way. But what I am curious, and again, if I can get right to a perfect balance where we're producing as many high quality offspring as we can, where we're introducing these animals, we're pit tagging them so we can figure out where they're going. Are they finding a territory of their own? Are they reproducing? That all is part of the first block of steps. The next one is, okay, well, how do we do all of that but ensure that the reproductive lifespan of that female is as long as it can be, and that it is, as things happen in life, we all edge towards senescence, where we all basically just kind of wither and die. And if you've been alive for a while, you've probably seen that happen to some sort of animal. If you've watched National Geographic back in the old days, they definitely showed that shit, and you feel sad about it. That's a fine thing. But if I can have a female, you know, the lifespan for the Ophaga, know, sometimes it's like 8 to 10, but sometimes you meet guys that have had one for 15 years and she's still breeding. What are they doing? Like, what are those guys doing that's different from everyone else? Is it just a remarkable animal, which can definitely happen? Is it something that they're doing with their diet, or is it something that maybe they're separating out and allowing her to not breed all the time? That's a question that is something that has to be weighed in to the equation of, we want healthy females, we want healthy offspring. The males, as a male, I can speak for us, we're going to be fine. We're going to do our thing. We're going to make more. Everything's going to be good. It's the females that count, and it's the offspring that kind of really count. So if we can get all the questions answered with the offspring, perfect. But if we can extend the reproductive lifespan of females, we definitely want to try to do it. One of the ways that I kind of suggested doing it is fostering. Whether you do it with Sylvatica or whether you, I know a lot of people now are hand rearing, and that's great. I do it here. You can actually have extremely healthy offspring there, and you don't even, I always use Ophaga eggs, but I'm not a purist in that. I know you can use Phyllobates eggs and Dendrobates eggs, and I think Zimmerman, that paper I referenced, I think they use there was another paper that used red-eyed tree frog eggs, and I think that didn't go well. But people are always experimenting with stuff. So let's say we have a Lamani that lays six eggs, same scenario as last time, six eggs, transports four, feeds three. There's two then that didn't get transported. So if you can take those two, put them in a test tube, and raise them, then that means the reproductive lifespan, the reproductive output of that female just went from 3 to 5, right? And that's artificial, but that counts. In my world, that counts. At Zoo Cali, that counts. Because what we're talking about is that means those are high quality offspring. The female had to do no extra work. And she, because she created them, has produced 5 instead of 3. Right, things like that. I have a group of Sylvatica that foster some large obligates. They're doing Antrochinensis right now. And they'll come out small. They'll come out a little bit smaller, so I can supplement with Terribilis if I need to. I can supplement with Familial. If I put it in there, they're going to eat it. And I can just clear out the vitelline jelly, and we're good to go. Wash it out. It's just like... it's an increased number of produced offspring, and that can be the difference.
That's fascinating. Wow. Another thing that we had kind of hinted at, and that you and I actually, I don't think we mentioned it the last time Carlos and Jack and I got to talk, and and I'm having Jack on the show again in a couple of weeks too. It was the sexing. You had some sort of a sexing kit that you were developing.
Right.
What happened with that project? Did that still become like something that happened, or you're still working on it? What was, cause I was so excited, and I was like, he told me not to say anything about it. So I didn't. What's going on with that project?
Well, I did. I actually have two of them kind of made. And what it does is it reads the hormone profile expressed in the through the skin of Ophaga. And you use, actually, it's really old work. It's colorimetrics, which sounds like a Saturday Night Live thing. But it's kind of an older field of study. And it's basically using reagents to bring some sort of color indicator into the presence of a substance. So the works that I used to build this thing were from 1938 and 1941. And basically I ordered this chemical to be used as a reagent, built a bath, so I could spray the so originally what this was for was to if you're up in the Anchikaya and you have a frog, you want to know if it's a male or female, and you can't tell from the ventral side looking at the distended tissue of the male, or if it's a young male, you don't know. You could whip this thing out. Something you could keep in a pocket. You could whip it out, spray into a reservoir, add the reagent, and have it come back. It's pink for testosterone. And I could do one that was red for estrogens. And then I discovered that, right when I was kind of getting really busy with that, I discovered that I could do it in a much simpler way. And I feel a lot better with that. You obviously want to put your frogs in as little stress as possible, but figuring out how to pop the mouth open, taking like a dulled toothpick, or I use an inoculation loop. And you can actually go in and find the vocal slits in males. And once you do it a couple of times, it is just clear as day. I don't even need to use the probe anymore. I can just look in the mouth and say, yep, that's a male. And I can put them down, good to go. I know I told you, but I'll be happy to, if anyone wants to contact me, I have a good video of it, and I'll be willing to send it. It's fun, and it's very helpful for my project, because when I'm doing metabolic work on Pamelio, I need to know who's a male and who's a female, so I can go through them all, pop their mouths open, and I can look and say, okay, you're a female, you go in this tank, you're a male, you can go with her, you know. So the hormone sexing kit was a preliminary success. I had about like a 92% positivity rate. When you start getting too young, it tends to get a little muddled sometimes. One, because the surface area of the skin wasn't able to produce enough of the hormones that I was looking for, but also they're immature. They don't have exactly what it really looked for, androgens, not just testosterone, but with the vocal slit technique, if you have delicate enough hands, you can do it for, I did it with, a Pamelio that was about a month and a half out of the water. I could tell it was a male because they have it when they're young. The slits are already there.
I was going to be, my next question was, you know, how early you could ID it. But at the same token, I mean, again, forgive my ignorance, because I never really even thought to ask anybody this, but at what point during development does a frog become male or female? Or at least with these species, I hear me out. I'm thinking about, again, I'm always thinking about everything through the fish mode. Black sea bass is a common species where I am. They all start off as female. As their numbers increase, they become male, and you get breeding males. I never even really thought anybody to ask anybody at what point do they are they born male or female? Are they born kind of neutral? And I never really thought to ask that.
Oh yeah, what a great question for this political climate, but I think once they get to adulthood, they're kind of locked in. I know there's probably some that in nature there's exceptions for everything, whether or not you can adjust the frog's sex in when they're young, that's totally plausible. I think there's probably ways that you could do it. I'm not sure if it would be temperature or if it would be another hormone that you could add in that would lead to the development of ovaries instead of testes. But, that's also a thing that's fairly conserved in even in people. That's why, men have nipples, but they do not use them. And so that's because sex is determined. Or becomes expressed after the formation of that of a nipple. So, I think you could probably figure out a way to do that. But I'm sure there is someone working on that, because amphibians are very, they interact with the outside environment a lot. That's you can medicate a frog with a solution, just putting them in a petri dish with it. You know, so the idea that maybe when they're young, you couldn't introduce something to the water. Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, I never thought to ask any. I don't know why I picked now, but the sea bass thing always kind of comes to my head, and I'm like, well, there's so many different ways that this could happen. And again, not to lump all frogs together, because I mean, there's so many hundreds of different species. Oftentimes I feel like we overgeneralize, and maybe that's me just thinking of the whole Jurassic Park thing where they just took random frog DNA and turned it into dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Cause all the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are female.
Yeah.
They take genetics from a frog.
So, yeah.
Yeah, possibly. I know that clownfish do a lot of really cool stuff with that. You know, they change gender depending on who loses the fight, right? So,
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, especially when you think about a species that has so much parental involvement, it has to play some sort of a dynamic, I guess. Whereas with, I don't know, different species that don't have so much of a parental influence, it might not matter so much. I don't know. Again, just more food for thought.
Yeah, and I mean there are people that look into like hormone profiles but from the eggs to the offspring. I think that's something. There's a young lady at Stanford who I think they have a whole lab that focuses on certain things like that. I think they do. They tend to do. I think it's like the neurology of like the behaviors of OFA, but it's Lauren O'Connell. I've never actually met her. She does a lot of work with Sylvatica, but they focus on the evolution of OOFAGY and in specifically in the Sylvatica. So.
Yeah. It's again, it's another one of those topics that just get people thinking. So you have a project, King School. Tell us about that, because I know this is something that you were really looking forward to mentioning, and I thought it might be interesting to maybe wrap up with that project. Yes.
Yeah, and so the last time when I was on with Carlos and Jack, after we had kind of said everything, I said, hey, you know, I work at the Dallas World Aquarium. We are part of AZA, and what I can tell you is that there is a very real possibility that in the very near future, private keepers could play a pretty big role in at least expanding knowledge on captive protocols. When you talk about Ofega, you know, there's a couple of zoos that keep them, but not many, and they're not really there to innovate with them. My favorite thing to bring up on this is Michael Novi, who is at Rainforest Junkies. I was talking with him yesterday. I looked through the Zoological Information Management System, ZIMS, and I looked for how many lemur leaf frogs were produced this year in every zoo in the United States, including Gamboa and one of the other places in Central America. It was like 40. And I asked him, I was like, how many have you produced in 1 year? What's the max? He's like, like over 500. And so the idea that a guy like that, you know, who just in his basement in Cleveland is doing work that could be used if someone was so inclined to make a really big impact on that species. These are the kind of people we know really well in the large obligate community. People who should have at least a hold on the reins of trying to determine what's important and what they have seen in their careers. And so one of the things I asked is I said, hey, if you are interested in being a part of this, reach out to me. And I sent out my email, and a couple of weeks later, I got an email from a guy named Nick, who I think he's the head of the biology department at the King School in Connecticut. And he was telling me about, you know, the interest with the Lamani. They have a tank that they work with. They're building more tanks. They're expanding they have a pair. Now they have like seven, you know, and they're breeding. They're contacting zoos to see if they want to be a part. And I love that shit. That's great. I love it. one, because it's a way to, as a scientist, you always struggle to find a way to portray scientific information, or at least the interest in science, to kids, especially kids nowadays. And so he was telling me, you know, he has kids that are alumni that come back to be a part of it. And I think that that's something that's, that was so cool to me. And so I always stay in touch with Nick. You know, when I go down to Columbia, we're going to do a big video conference where Carlos and the team at Zucali are going to talk to Nick and the kids at the King School in Connecticut. But that to me is kind of what it's all about, is, you know, no matter what I do, I could do a ton of work, or I could quit tomorrow. If I have helped do something like that, that's a way for me as a person to facilitate others to do the work that I'm not capable of doing. And that's kind of what life is about. You know, we all have talents, and we all have things we're not good at. And the best way to ensure that the projects that we care about succeed is to have people who will fill those gaps and to coordinate and to cooperate. And I see this a lot. I help with the Dallas World Aquarium. I help a lot with the Orinoco crocodile projects we do here. And what you see is that crocodile people are vicious towards each other. I mean, they just, a lot of these places that you're just in awe, you can go see all these crazy crocodiles. Very few of them like each other. And I'm like, that's crazy to me. Like, that is the opposite of what I would want to have. Like, how are you supposed to coordinate anything if you can't even be cordial or I mean, at the very limit, cordial and understanding, but cooperative is almost a must. I'm thinking in April, I'm going up to, I think, for a baby shower in Connecticut, where my wife's family is from. And I'm hoping to go see the kids at the King School, because that stuff, you know, in a private school, these kids are doing work for a project that I work with, and I'd be willing to bet that in the future, one or some of those kids is going to make a real difference with the Ophelamani if they have the drive to. And I know that Nick is, you know, it sounds like an awesome program. Nick's doing a lot of good work with that. And like I said, man, that's what it's all about.
That's really amazing. I love stuff like that. I love involvement that's, you don't need a large institution to be the face of projects like these. And that's, I mean, number one, I also want to thank you again, because not everybody who is involved with zoos and aquariums wants to, and in many cases can't, come out and comment about issues, because that's kind of proprietary information. And I get that. I understand that. So I do want to thank you for, you know, actually talking to me, because the zoo and aquarium world has opened up more to me as the show has gone on. I mean, originally it was, you know, no one wanted to talk to me at all, which I get. But it's nice that you have this cooperative effort between people who are at the hobbyist level, at the breeder level, and institutions that have the resources to really put these animals in front of more people. And it's like, I feel like large institutions, again, have different goals than breeders and different goals than hobbyists. But at the same time, you know, I don't like, you know, keeping the fact that a lot of institutions get their information, their husbandry, whatnot, and their many times their animals from private individuals. I don't think that that should be like a dark secret. I think that that should be something that's rewarded.
Yeah. I mean, and it is kind of I think the most hobbyists, whether you're at that level or not, it's kind of a joke. Of course, the access to certain animals is kind of, it's shut off, right? So, like, I remember during COVID when Tiger King came out, you know, everybody's criticizing that guy. That's totally fine. I I agree. I actually went to the Winnie Woods Zoo when I was up in the Panhandle, or when I was up in North Texas, and you know, everything that documentary was insane. Also, that guy was probably producing hundreds of tigers a year. That might come in handy, you know, to someone. Whatever he's doing, I guess just feeding meat off a Walmart truck is how you get him to go. But again, the mode isn't really the interest. That's the interest later. But the result is the interest. And another good thing to put behind it is some sort of a financial incentive. Scimitar horned oryx are a species that was extinct in the wild. You know, had just been driven out. And now they're making a comeback. There's a multinational, multi-organizational effort to get these things reintroduced. And kind of, if you look at it, there are more scimitar horned oryx in Texas than there are in the rest of the world combined because people want to hunt them. And so there is some monetary. So is that something I support? Not exactly. But it's something that you can't quite ignore because someone figured out how to breed those things at a really high level. And answering all the questions that we've been talking about today, as far as fitness, can they survive in North Africa or the Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula, as they can in Texas, maybe, maybe not, but it'd be worth investigating, saying like, hey, how did you guys do that? You know? So, zoos don't want zoos at large don't want to do that. I'm blessed because I work for an individual. I have one boss and he is my boss, and whatever if I have an interest in something, I have to get him, you know, to see what I'm going on about. But he understands that a private person can be the person to make a difference. And some zoos, because they're organizations and because they don't want people to have the animals that they work with, they it's a bit of pearl clutching, in my opinion. Because, you know, you don't want just everybody having a tiger, right? Like that may not be great, but it is America. And I think if they want a tiger and they can prove that they can keep it, that's good. That, you know, good for them. You know, if you can keep a horse, you know, it's not exactly the same thing, but how long until, you know, people aren't allowed to keep those? You know, there's always a limiting factor. And the good thing is that they don't seem interested in Ophega very much. They don't really want to work with them. And so that's great. Now I can have people who are passionate about it, like the King School. I can have them on my side because I'm not limited on who I can talk to. I can get them involved. Maybe even get them down to Cali to work in the amphibian lab or something, some sort of life changing experience that might catapult someone who's passionate into someone who is living for that. Now that's their goal. They're going to go to college. They're going to go to grad school. They're going to become a scientist, and they're going to, continue on down that road. And like I said, if I can do that, I've done my job.
That's a great way to give back. You know, I mean, it's especially working in the type of environment that you do, which is, I mean, again, it's a big public face for so many things. And, you know, being able to transfer that into, you know, young kids coming up, learning and being able to really be hands-on and whatnot. Like I love that. I put so much value in that. Seeing an animal in an aquarium or a zoo, it's amazing, but being able to actually work with it and not have that barrier is priceless. I love stuff like that.
And if someone comes up to the aquarium and they have a question about a frog and they say, hey, can I talk to someone about this? I'm going to show up. And I'm going to talk to them. Right now it doesn't happen that often. If you come to the Dallas World Aquarium and ask for me, you know, it depends on how many people do it. But that's my life. This is my life. You know, this is what I do. And I love helping be, especially if it's kids, man. If it's kids, you know, I'll spend a lot of time answering questions and engaging with them, man, because they got the brightest future, you know.
Yeah, I love that. And I just, I hate barriers. Yeah, I understand that has to exist. I will admit, even to myself, I've advocated for some degree of gatekeeping because I do believe that you can't just have everybody going in, you know, going crazy. But not having the barriers is just, it's so beneficial. I mean, that's something that can make or break someone's interest for life. And just breaking that down is just such a vital component. I mean, I can't name names, but I've had conversations off air privately with people from zoos, aquariums, et cetera. And they really, you know, I say, hey, look, you know, come on the show, come on, talk to me. Like, well, you know, we've got a public relations department and we've got a board and I've got to answer this, that. And I'm like, all right, I get it. I understand, you know, that's fine. But it's just, it's such a barrier because like all I want to do is talk. Yep. You know what I mean?
It's almost like a 1984 style thing. They just don't, they have an opinion, but they have their own opinion. And that can't be the opinion of the zoo. And anytime that they say it, it's a big brother situation, you know, they might react because we got a PR. And it's like, I'm not asking. I mean, even if you're a keeper, you know, if it's behind the scenes stuff, it's behind the scenes stuff, but you're a person, you got opinions. Like, what are your opinions? I agree that can be a bit clinch. There's obviously stuff that I can't talk about the aquarium with our collection, but I'm generally pretty free and open, and as long as I can talk to the director about it and he gives me the okay, I'm good to go. I think he trusts me at this point. So,
we've covered a lot of ground at this point. It's too late to go. It's too late to go back.
Well, and that's good. I'm good with pretty much everything I said on here. So
yeah,
it's all good.
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people, look, you know what? At the end of the day, it's just two of us talking. That's it. We're talking about something that we enjoy. We're talking about something that's important. There's many different players in this game. And I think that it's important that we all are able to communicate as peers and as equals.
Yep.
And like, to me, I mean, again, having people like you, I mean, you've got an amazing career. You the curator of amphibians at a zoo. That's awesome. I mean, the fact that you're talking to me, I mean, I'm the one who feels privileged. Because I get to talk to people like you. I get to talk to researchers. I get to talk to all these different people. And I feel like we need more of that. I feel like that's a more productive way of getting things done than everyone creating these little, you know, little fiefdoms that, you know, no one wants to acknowledge that the other person exists.
Yeah. Can't do that. I'm much more inclined to have conversations such as these than talking with someone in secret, because it's, you know, it's important to get this stuff out there. And I have a lot riding on the maturity of the hobbyists, of the people who are passionate about these, to one, call me out on my bullshit which I'm not going to take personal because it's a career. It's important. We're all trying to work towards a better thing here. And that is science, man. Kicking around ideas and figuring out what's right and what's wrong, or at least what's supported and what's not. I hate calling myself a scientist because I'm just a dude, but I am because I appreciate knowing what's what. And there's a lot. I mean, most people appreciate that. So I've put a pretty big wager on the hobbyists in this one, not in the zoos, not in the researchers, but because the ones I've met, I'm pretty good with that.
Chris, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Like, with this Lamani project going on, where do you want to be 5 years from now with this type of research and this type of a project?
I would hope that in 5 years we've answered a lot of the questions about offspring fitness that we have continued to build our true in situ stuff up in the mountains where the Lamani are, with the communities there, we figured out patterns, movement patterns. Once we release, what happens? How long does it take them to get settled? What is our mortality rate? Obviously, very important to know. If we got an 80% mortality rate, it's back to the drawing board, because that's unacceptable. And I hope that in 5 years we have a good part of that figured out. And I hope that we're working on understanding, getting, I mean, a big part of the future of this project is a population genetics work, knowing, is there genetic transfer between the Anchakaya, the Anchakayensis? Are they, will they come up into the mountains and breed with the Lamani? Is that something we need to account for? And then just understanding the health of the population, like how much inbreeding is going on, how much of it is just like one big male with all the bromeliads controlling everything and breeding everything, you know? And that's a project that will take maybe a decade to do really well, and will be a continuing project. I'm not sure if I'm the person for that, which is why I put so much faith in other people. I could be the one to do it, but, I have a lot of projects at the aquariums, not just Ophaga stuff. Ophaga are the ones that I'm spending a lot of my time on. Once I finish my PhD and I kind of understand the very, very basic foundation of the cost of reproduction with the Ophaga, I'm hoping that I can continue to build on that and start to understand things at a subcellular level. What mitochondrial adaptations do you have to increase stress of reproduction, which is something that my lab looks at quite a bit and is super exciting. It sounds complex. It is very complex, but it's just something that I'm very interested by, and also understanding the role of that the hybrids play. There's a little bit of data to suggest that one of the early hybrids is now completely isolated. Is that a species? What species concept will we use this time? Probably have to use a couple, but all these questions to ask, in 5 years, I think we'll be getting around to starting to figure out those and being able to sample those, so we can get some understanding.
Amazing. We got to do this again sometime.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I just like I did last time, I want to encourage people, if you have questions, if you have ideas, I put this in one of the earlier sections, but I didn't mention it. I designed some rearing cups that allows me to quantify the number of eggs that a female is feeding to her tadpoles. I have those freely available. I won't charge. I don't know how much shipping will be to wherever you are, but if you have large obligates and you want to know that, as long as you promise to give me some information so I can expand my sample size, I'll even show you a video how to install them so that they'll be really clear. You can watch tadpoles develop and all that. That and the video on the sexing, trying to find the vocal slits. If you just email me at cab0247@auburn.edu, AUBURN.edu. Just shoot me an email. I'm passionate about this shit, so I like to talk about it. And if you like to talk about it, then I'd love to be able to increase your experience with that. The more conversations that go on, the more we whittle down. And that's a goal of mine.
That's great. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk to this. I'm looking back, and I think it was a year the last time we spoke. I think it was April of 2023. So I've been waiting a year to have this discussion. I'm really glad that we finally got around to it, because I had so many questions and you answered so many of them. It's been really interesting. And the fact that the Lamani project is doing well and progressing at the rate that it is another just a all around good thing. Are there any links or anything that you want to, I'm going to include links in the show notes, but is there anything you want to mention to the listeners that they might want to check out before we break?
Some of the stuff that we brought up, the King School work, I think they have a website. I need to ask Nick. Maybe I can have him send it to me so I can plug it. We're trying to get a more user-friendly version of the Lamani project, a website for it, so that people can go on and interact, can see what everything that's going on. As far as my stuff, if you want to know what I'm doing, just email me. I'll talk about it. It's part of being a PhD student that you have to talk about what you're doing, because it's how you convince yourself that you know it. So it's just an always evolving thing. I tend not to have much public, so I don't do like social media or anything, but if anyone wants to talk about it, you shoot me an email. About any of the stuff we talked about. So
awesome. All right, everyone, again, I want to big thanks to Chris for coming on and talking to us about all this. Again, I've been looking forward to this interview for a year, and I'm really, really happy we got to have this discussion. And of course, thank you all of you for listening. I always appreciate the input. I know you guys are enjoying these longer episodes where we get really more into these topics. So that's what we're going to keep doing. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I did as well. And I will catch up with you again next time.